The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Looking only at natural emergence, there's a huge amount of predictive science that could be brought to bear, but it does require an investment. And again, most of the places where we would most want to have that investment pay off are places where we might have the least ability to engage or the least sophistication to partner and create the kinds of environments where that is realistic. But it doesn't mean it can't happen.
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 7th. 2021. COVID-19 has shown us all that pandemics aren't just a public health issue, but a national security one as well. Are America's national security institutions prepared to address this threat? And what role should the intelligence community play in working with public health officials during such pandemics? This live recording of the Lawfare podcast tackles these questions and many others, featuring a discussion with Congressman Eric Swalwell, who represents California's 15th Congressional District and sits on the House Intelligence Committee, Dr. Julie Gerberding, who served as Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention from 2002 to 2009, and now is a senior leader at the pharmaceutical company Merck, and Matt Barrett, a former CIA Assistant Director and head of its Global Issues Mission Center, and now co-founder of the Center for Anticipatory Intelligence at Utah State University. This was held in conjunction with two programs at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. First, the Michael V. Hayden Center for Intelligence, Policy, and International Security, and second, the Biodefense Program. This podcast has been edited slightly for length. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 7th, COVID and Intelligence, with Eric Swalwell, Julie Gerberding, and Matt Barrett.
Welcome to this live recording of the Lawfare Podcast. Before we get to COVID-19 specifically and things happening now, it would help all of us to briefly hear each of you talk about your experiences of the intersection of public health and national security from different institutional perspectives that you're familiar with. And I'll start with you, Eric. Your district includes a federally funded research center and development center, which is the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. And they've done some work related to biodefense and public health over the years. And of course, being in Congress, you have a window on a whole lot of these issues and how they intersect. So I'd like to start with you briefly to talk about how Lawrence Livermore and other national labs can play into these issues and how you think Congress oversees those issues and adds value.
Thank you so much, David. And thank you to the Hayden Center. And excited to be with you, Julie and Matthew on this. I'm privileged to represent Livermore, California, which has not only Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, but also Sandia National Laboratory. And so it's approximately 10,000 physicists who live in my congressional district. And so I'm proud to boast that I may have the smartest congressional district in the country. Don't hold it against them that they voted for me. I promise you, they're very, very smart, hardworking people. In the district. And you may have heard of Lawrence Livermore in the past because of their leading the way with super and hyper computing. And so high performance computing and the investments they've made there have always landed them in the top five every year when the race takes place among Japan, Taiwan, China, the US for the fastest supercomputer. We're always in the top five. And that's critically important right now as we're trying to crunch data on COVID-19. And so Lawrence Livermore has been tasked by the White House to provide COVID-19 researchers worldwide with access to the most important and critical high performance computing resources. And so this is not the first time they've been asked to do this, by the way. For the past two decades, lab scientists at Livermore have developed and deployed what they call commercialized numerous diagnostic technologies. And so they're applying that right now. And they also created a COVID-19 portal, a data portal to expedite access to modeling results. And so as we see what's going on in South Africa right now, when they turned around a new variant quite quickly, Lawrence Livermore does the same. They are able to process quite quickly and turn around data to scientists, to the White House, to the CDC, so that it can educate policymakers as we determine, you know, what do we do next? So very proud of the work we're doing there. And frankly, David, it feels like everything, whether it's pandemics or climate chaos, is accelerating. We're seeing the 500-year flood every couple of years now, the unseasonable hurricanes every season now, unseasonable wildfires happening over and over, especially in California. And of course, about you know, three pandemics in the last 20 years. And so it's all the more necessary for us to deploy resources that we have in the federal government to try and understand and inform policymakers.
That is a great overview of Livermore in particular. But quickly, also on the congressional side, is a lot of what you're talking about is the lab analyzing these events and presumably helping others in the government to understand them. What role does Congress play other than the funding and the oversight of their operations?
Right. So, of course, you know, we fund Lawrence Livermore to maintain the nuclear deterrent that we have. But from what we learn in maintaining and upgrading our nuclear deterrent, we can apply those sciences to understanding what's going on with climate, what's going on in the energy sectors, and of course, what's going on with pandemics. And so putting all hands on deck, you know, with our scientists right now to help with COVID is critically important. And so that's the key role, the front and center role that the lab employees are playing right now. And so frankly, the recent investments that we've made through the infrastructure bill, through what I hope will be passed soon and Build Back Better, will continue to make investments in infrastructure and the sciences to include Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. And so it's the tip of the spear as it relates to processing, you know, the data that's out there on pandemics, on wildfires, on climate chaos, and of course, the most important role they play being a deterrent to others on the nuclear stage.
Thank you. Julie, you've had impressive experiences in leadership roles during previous pandemics, such as the anthrax scare in 2001 and the SARS crisis a few years later. And I'm hoping you can characterize for everybody how the national security apparatus intersected with the CDC and the National Institute and helped during those crises, and what ways it didn't help during those crises.
Well, thank you. First of all, thank you for including me in this discussion, because this is a fascinating perspective on something that I think has been long overlooked. For me personally, the convergence of public health and national security was brought home very early in my training at San Francisco General Hospital, when we were actually visited by Robert Gates as HIV was unfolding in Africa. And he came to ask the question, what would be the security instabilities that a pandemic like HIV could conceivably cause? I was a chief resident at the time, and I had never, ever considered, you know, that relationship. So led to a very deep, I think, dive into what the destabilizing forces of an infectious disease outbreak, especially one at that time that had so much stigma and no real interventions. And that theme of kind of convergence between the public health threat and the intelligence community has stayed with me ever since. So when I was at CDC and the 911 attacks occurred, followed about a month later with the anthrax attacks, it was an amazing experience to be working initially primarily with the FBI, because we were both investigating the anthrax attacks. And, you know, the intelligence community, the FBI in particular, saw what we were dealing with as a crime scene. We in public health saw it as an infectious disease outbreak problem. And there was really no connection between how evidence was collected and handled, the chain of custody. All of these issues were real points of friction initially, but ultimately, as we worked together, we embedded FBI at CDC, we embedded CDC at FBI and Quantico, we shared laboratory technologies and so forth. And ultimately, we ended up writing a paper together on our joint investigation parameters that was published in Science. So I think that was learning on the fly, got off to kind of a rough start from time to time, but we really, for a while, learned how to collaborate in the context of a public health investigation. So, you know, when you kind of fast forward into the more global outbreaks that happened, at least during my tenure after that, the intelligence community was, in my view, an extremely important arm of understanding what was really happening. I visited the NSA, I visited, you know, actually went to the National Training Center for a different set of reasons to really try to understand the operational aspects of response. But the members of the intelligence community have all relevant contributions to make in terms of predicting bio threats, investigating bio threats, and hopefully ultimately preventing them from emerging in the first place. So I think that conversation has not been very visible in the current pandemic, and I look forward to that part of our discussion tonight.
Of course, officials at a senior level at the State Department and the Pentagon and the White House all have security clearances. So having intelligence officials come and give briefings is relatively easy. Sometimes the logistics get hard. And Eric, as you know, on the Hill, sometimes the logistics get in the way. But usually you can get people who match up with the right clearances. But that wasn't as true with a lot of public health officials who don't always have security clearances. Did you find that was a hindrance to some of the synergies we're talking about?
Well, it was. I mean, obviously, I and the top scientists at CDC had the appropriate clearances, but at the state and local level, essentially no public health officials had security clearances. And it was very difficult to share the kind of information that was particularly relevant. If you have a white powder in your post office, these were lessons learned, I think. And I'm not sure that problem has been completely solved. So we do need to find ways to provide at least certain categories of clearance so that people can have information about public health threats. But that also requires a different kind of training and exercising of that community so that they're prepared and understand the proper procedures for handling that and so forth. It's hard to do that in the broad network of what our system currently includes because there are so many different components of the public health network. And at the local level, sometimes there's essentially no there, but yet there are people in those communities who need access to that information. So even that little segment of the convergence is something that is hard to work out.
To Julie's point, we are undertaking on the House Intelligence Committee, what we're calling a COVID deep dive. And part of our look at this is what Julie brought up, which is making sure that you can read in more people so that you can share intelligence. Overall, as you know, David, and also Matthew, we are too slow to approve most security clearances. It takes, you know, well over a year for most folks to get cleared. So that's a mission priority for us on the committee as well, is to expedite those, considering, you know, the new data resources that we have to look at, you know, someone's background, but especially for a pandemic. Wanting to make sure that scientists are read in and have access to the best intelligence.
Sure, thank you. Matt, bring the intelligence perspective into this. From your role running the Global Issues Mission Center at CIA, which did include within it many issues, but among those, public health and its relation to national security. What does intelligence have to offer? What's unique about the business of analyzing and presenting intelligence that you found that the enterprise there could offer to what we would have called non-traditional national security customers like public health officials?
Yeah, sure, David. And it's nice to be with you all tonight. I'm going to apologize to your listeners up front. One of the participants in the Barrett-Glanz Thanksgiving was a nasty cold that I picked up. So I'm speaking an octave or two lower than usual, but I will try to get my words out.
But we are in an era, Matt, where if you can say that someone came over for Thanksgiving and gave you a cold, everybody is overjoyed because it is not something else.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think across the clan, I have four sons who are all married. I think we've had about 127 COVID tests. Couple things. The IC can bring resources to the game, okay, and some different types of resources, but some serious resources. You know, you mentioned that the Global Issues Mission Center, which the agency after I retired, you know, and this gets at a problem that I think we need to talk about. I'm really glad you've got Congressman Swalwell with us tonight for the committee he sits on, but we still fumble a little bit at the collaboration piece with the science agencies, and we've got to get past that. We can't wait until we have a crisis interface before we sort of say, hey, we need to collaborate more, you know, across some of these different places. But the intel community can bring, has a lot of resources. They have to be turned and focused. I had, as you say, you know, that Mission Center, which the agency has recently stood back up, thank heavens. And for our listeners, Mission Centers are like the combatant commands. They comprise all elements of CIA. So you've got ops in there, you got analysis, you've got science and technology, you have digital innovation. And so the whole point of it is to bring a more multi-domain enterprise together to go after problems and challenges. On the issues, some of the issues that we covered were no duh for CIA, global counter-narcotics efforts, strategic resources, conflict. On issues such as climate change and health, we didn't do climate change science and health science. We did the national security implications of climate change and that. So part of the challenge in covering that, and we had some really bright folks in there, part of the challenge in covering some of those topics from an intelligence community perspective is at least a couple of my colleagues here tonight know, it can be kind of hard to go out and say, hey, we need to task a satellite to go find some pathogens. Really, we're kind of busy with Syria and China and Iran and a few other things right now. So sometimes that's not a very motivating target to go after until it blows up in our face. One of the challenges we have, the collaboration piece, science agencies and intel agencies, is we have to be careful with our science agency colleagues because the intel community, you know, they have their own contacts overseas. They're great contacts, and we can scare them off. If they know that science agencies are, or if they perceive that we are, you know, too close with the intel agencies, you know, remember for a lot of those countries, intel agencies aren't warm, fuzzy organizations, and they don't want anything to do with anything that has the word intel in it. So we got to figure out a way to be more systematic and strategic in collaborating across those worlds, because a whole lot of folks at CIA and the intel community, they don't have a clue what some of the implications of some of the stuff that's being picked up in the science agencies are doing. And if we don't figure out how to efficiently sort of share some information with each other, we're going to have another one of these blow up on us. And then we'll figure out how to collaborate. We got to do it in advance. And I'm just going to put a marker down. We may come back to this later. One of the concerns I have about the pandemic and the way U.S. tends to orient to crises, whether it's 9/11 or, you know, ISIS or a bunch of other things, is we tend to pick apart the crisis behind us. We figure out, you know, it's the old coach's folly. You spend a lot of time figuring out exactly why you just lost the game yesterday, but you're not terribly imaginative in the game that's coming at you next week or next year in 5 years. One of the things I hope we can touch on a little bit is biology. We're all happy about what it's done for us with the vaccine. It's also made some really dangerous tools more accessible to a broader base of actors. And we need to figure out how to stay ahead of that one.
Right. In terms of moving forward, back to you, Eric, you have called for national intelligence assets to be much more involved on public health issues, in part through your advocacy of, if I have them right, the Bioattribution Act and the BioReport Act. What would those specific pieces of legislation do to energize this contribution of intelligence to public health emergencies?
Yeah, so the Bioattribution Act would require us, you know, to explore and report out on the origin of a pandemic, of a virus. And I don't think it has been weaponized, unfortunately, with COVID-19 as to what the origin was. But I don't think it's unreasonable that the intelligence community should be tasked with reporting to the president, you know, what the origin of a virus is, whether it was, you know, lab-borne, whether it was in a wet market, as is suspected in Wuhan, or whether it was, you know, something that was designed and purposeful by a state or non-state actor. And so just formalizing the responsibility of the government to know that, you know, knowledge is power during a pandemic, and we should, you know, make sure that we can leverage our resources to streamline disease intelligence and identify the origin of a new biological threat. It also would increase, to Matt's point earlier and Julie's point earlier, some of the sharing issues exposed by COVID-19. It would help us be better protected by leveraging resources from both the intelligence community and some of the other science offices in the federal government. And the National Security Council Modernization Act that I wrote would give the Secretary of Health and Human Services a seat on the National Security Council. So again, this is that convergence of intelligence and health policy. But as I continue to think about how we can best understand what is coming ahead, and to Matt's point, not fighting the last war, but getting ready for the next one, I would be interested in what Matt thinks about human intelligence, and whether we should have our collectors not just looking at, you know, plans and intentions of world leaders, but also looking at different health and science departments to see if there is, you know, a risk of a pandemic, you know, in the case of Wuhan, if they knew long, and it looks like they did long before it was reported to the rest of the world, that had we been, you know, really zeroing in on that, could we have better protected ourselves and closed ourselves off from Asia much earlier to protect it from coming from us? And I don't know if that, you know, is something I have the capability to do now, or if we would have to plus up and increase training, but it does seem like we have human opportunities to collect there as well.
I'd love to jump in on that. Yes. Now, you know, we'll follow that up. The Intel community will follow that up with Congressman. Yeah, we'd like to go out of that, but like everyone else, we have constrained resources. Sure. Just touch on a couple of things the Intel community has done and could do more of. Tell you whether the science agency in some country where you're very worried about some disease erupting are lying to us. Are they lying to our, are they lying to their colleagues in our science agencies about what's really happening? The Intel community is trying to get into that, to get into the inside baseball and find out. So that's, you know, clearly an area where they probably need to do more. I mean, we're looking at a pandemic now. We got some issues of climate change. I think we're going to have to broaden our view, and this is going to require, as Congressman knows, some culture, a little bit of cultural shift in some of the Intel agencies. But, you know, we worry about China. I get it. I had the Undersecretary of Research and Education from Department of Agriculture visit me not longer after I stepped into my assistant director job, just a courtesy visit. And I asked her at one point, I said, you know, tell me how, you know, I don't have science, but I got an econ background. I said, how worried are your scientists about climate change? And she about jumped across the table, said, really worried. And I said, what is it they worry most about? Is it just, you know, the effects of climate change on crops? And she said, no. She said, we, you know, our genetic engineering is getting pretty good. If we have a sense of what's going to happen with temperature and moisture, we can start to design crops and be able to be more hardy and adjust. And so we have some tools in those areas. What worries them is they don't have an ability to predict how the shifts in climate and moisture are going to affect the diseases that affect crops. That's what she said at the time worries her. You know, the Intel agencies could get into some of those other science institutions overseas who are not willing to tell us some of the things that they're researching and finding out that would be of use to us, and share that information with us. So I think we have to stand back and, again, you know, look ahead, try to be imaginative to the things that could be coming at us. It's constrained resources. I get it. That's just a reality. But I'm not sure, you know, here's the thing, Congressman. I'm not sure that when we have those strategic discussions, in fact, I am sure, we don't have a broad enough base of folks in the room. We just don't. I come from an institution that says, hey, multidisciplinary analysis. We've got econ, political, leadership, military, targeting. That's a great start. In the classrooms I'm doing up here at Utah State University, we've got 30 majors in the room, and we're throwing problems at them. And as somebody with 32 years into the Intel community, grad and undergrad, and some professional students, I'm kind of blown away about what happens with some design when you put 30 different skill sets in a room and turn them to a national security. You get all sorts of ideas and connections that you would have never imagined.
Right. And Julie, I want to turn to you on a different angle of this question, because here it is. In the video version of this, Eric and Matt and I are all nodding along like, yeah, you know, more intelligence going after this, getting more information. But collecting intelligence itself presents some new issues in the public health arena. And I've had public health professionals say to me that they're uncomfortable with a greater role of intelligence in things like disease surveillance and pandemic preparedness, because, among other things, the use of intelligence on public health issues raises the risk that health agencies and programs may be viewed by some, especially overseas, as intelligence agencies themselves. Because the best way to find out what's happening inside a Chinese hospital or a Chinese lab is to have someone who can speak that language and walk the walk. And suddenly you have a whole bunch of doctors from America who are suspect in certain countries because of that, which actually inhibits the scientific enterprise. So I'm wondering if you can hit that from your side to explain, from a public health perspective, what is the cost-benefit analysis of linking up with intelligence in a way that could actually risk some of the gains of pure scientific cooperation?
Yeah, I think we put a very high premium on trust, trust in science, trust in those kinds of collaborations. I know during my tenure, we had a memorandum of understanding with the China CDC, and we had the Chinese CDC leaders come to Atlanta. The CDC US leaders went to China. We planted a friendship tree when they built their new facility and so forth. So we built a relationship on trust. And for a period of time, we had pretty good situation awareness when there was an outbreak of infectious disease of public health concern in China, because we were training the scientists together. We supported the field epidemiology training program there, which embedded some of our best epidemiologists at the China CDC and vice versa. So, you know, that's controversial, it's tricky, but I think from a science to science perspective, that's always the best place to start. Having said that, I think we have to also look at it from the other side of the coin. And when I was watching the early days of the COVID pandemic and I saw what was going on the cruise ships, and my first thought was Navy. Then we saw the outbreak on one of our naval cruisers, and I just realized that we just taught enemies how to, you know, knock out our Navy. And we have to get really serious about the fact that every infectious disease can be exploited by bad actors to cause extreme harm. And we're learning exactly how harmful some of these pathogens really can be. And I think, as you were alluding to earlier, if we're one step ahead of the pathogen with vaccines or countermeasures, that gives us an offensive advantage. And not saying us that we would do that, but I'm saying that, you know, a bad actor who knew that he could protect his own community with countermeasures, but others were not as protected, really has an offensive weapon advantage. In public health, we're not really used to thinking about that, because probably for us, Mother Nature is the usual enemy. And sometimes accidents are the second most feared enemy, lab accidents, et cetera. But I think we've all grown up a little bit in the last few years and have come to realize that this convergence is something that, you know, there are spaces in here where we can, I think, comfortably collaborate. For example, everyone's been talking about prediction, but the upstream, you know, predicting where the hot spots for pathogen emergence are, whether they're plant or animal pathogens, using a lot of the information we have about the situation awareness of what's going on in communities, where is there a change in ordering hospital supplies? You know, what is happening in a location of interest that would be surrogate markers for perhaps the early emergence of an infectious disease? That kind of fusion of observation, surveillance, and both public as well as covert information, we have to have fusion centers where we can bring that together, because it is a matter of national security. But I think, you know, it's not going to be for every public health official to be participating in that, nor should it be the job of every intelligence official to be participating in it. But in a very specialized way, we need to explore how can we build a broader base of that convergence to really build the science, and as well as experiment with, you know, how can we get earlier indicators and have a better predictive framework for understanding where we should be focusing our attentions, because we can't look at the world. So we really do need to understand hotspots, in my words. I think it's hard, but it's also exciting, and an area where the tools that we do have can, and particularly the digital tools, can take us a lot further than even when I was at CDC. So hopefully we can make some real progress here.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work.
You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
Yeah, so I think on our best day, if we get this right, you have Matt's former company working with Julie's former outfit and maybe an NSA targeter, and they're talking about, okay, in XYZ country, who is the health and science person that we would want to, you know, target to better have that disease, you know, surveillance information that could be yielded because we're suspecting that, you know, there could be an outbreak there. That would be on our best day. The worst day, and I think you were alluding to this earlier, David, would be, you know, in 2010 in Abbottabad, Pakistan, you know, we ran a hepatitis B vaccination program to try and collect the DNA of Osama bin Laden. That's from, you know, public reporting that's out there. And that has led to vaccine hesitancy, you know, among people fearing that, you know, the vaccine is an intelligence agency ruse for something else. So that, you know, kind of balancing what the most we can get out of that convergence of intelligence and scientists working together, and then, you know, mitigating against, you know, what the risk is if it's exposed or perceived in a way that could actually, you know, work against your overall mission.
Yeah, I'm thinking about that scenario you just raised. And if I have an NSA targeter in the room and some CIA operators and analysts and some CDC epidemiologists, let's say, and you're trying to get at this potential source of information, perhaps in a country where they're not sharing per protocols, the first thing I think of is you ask that CDC official to say, well, you know this person, that's why we're talking to you. So can you broker an introduction to one of our officers? And suddenly you risk that relationship. That's a tough balance. It weighs short-term versus long-term ethics. It also competing responsibilities of public health versus national security that are really thorny for many issues, but particularly when it comes to global health, as you point out with the example of Abbottabad. Matt, I want to turn to you on a question from the audience related to this, because it was already brought up that the intelligence community has been asked questions about the origins of COVID-19. And you've all seen that assessment, the unclassified version that's been put out, exceptionally detailed in terms of what agencies give confidence levels to and what they don't, and the reasons why they can't be highly confident of one origin story versus another. It's not merely a CIA mission center thing anymore. This is an intelligence community assessment that was put out. So should there actually be a national intelligence officer, a mission manager for the intelligence community overall on health security intelligence and not just a global issues center at CIA?
Yes. I don't think there's a presumption or an assumption in, or implicit in that that this isn't either or, right? Not either a national intelligence manager for health pandemic concerns or a global issues mission center. I think, you know, both. Yeah, yes. But those NIMs have, coming out of the ODNI, I've got to be a little careful here, but part of their orientation is the tasking piece. You know, they're in close proximity to the National Intelligence Council, where, you know, a lot of those national level estimates are made. But so my short answer is yes, it seems as of this point, this is sufficiently concerning and poses a sufficient threat.
Yeah.
I think in terms of something such as that, I think one of the challenges that all of our institutions have is we become captive to the inertia of what, you know, this is organizational theory 101. We become captive to the inertia of how we've been doing things for the last 5, 10, 15, 20, 200 years. And these institutions are full of really smart people that might benefit by having a few more percent really creative folks in there. You know, people from not your typical backgrounds, but really creative folks to ask questions that I think sometimes we just don't until, again, crisis blows up on us. And then, you know, we're a resource planet. Then we'll turn all the resources in the world to it. And still sometimes, particularly in those moments, we're not approaching it with sufficient nuance and multi-domain expertise. We have the hammers, you know, we turn everything into nails and we bring the hammers to the game.
Yeah. A lot of what we've talked about so far would, you know, require better cooperation, better collaboration. But as several of you have pointed out, additional resources often are needed to build these things up. And Eric, a practical question. Is there an appetite among enough of your colleagues on the Hill to use this COVID-19 crisis as an opportunity to direct those resources? Because I got to be honest, I look at Congress and I see some of your colleagues who aren't even willing to simply wear a mask in response to this crisis. And I'm a little bit skeptical about the ability to develop a national consensus around a major investment in expanding intelligence resources to help out with public health issues. What do you think?
Well, the same colleagues who are not willing to wear a mask, and I sit with them in our SCIF hearing room, are also the colleagues that berate intelligence officials because they believe that they're not being honest about the COVID origins. So it's almost as if, yes, don't like them or go to them because you want them to care about this public health crisis, but maybe pander to their concerns about China, you know, hiding its role in the pandemic if that's going to get them to authorize funding for additional resources to understand it. So I think there's many ways to skin a cat. And if that's their concern, and at the end of the day, we land at the same place, you know, to authorize more resources, then so be it. And we were able to get in the Intelligence Authorization Act of 2021, which we're waiting, you know, to get a vote on the floor, additional resources, you know, as it relates to the pandemic. Now, yes, there are concerns that you express that they don't take it as seriously as they need to as it relates to masking, vaccinating, et cetera. But they are concerned about China. And if that's their concern, and China, you know, is the world's largest wet market, so to speak, as far as the number of wet markets they have and what that means for public health, then let's find a way, you know, to leverage that. Mm-hmm.
Julie, it was just a few months ago that you wrote an article in Time magazine, and among other things, called for efforts to advance so-called prediction science on some of these pandemic issues. And I did notice that just in August or September, I don't recall which, the Center for Forecasting and Outbreak Analytics within the CDC was stood up and given something like $200 million for initial funding for use of analytics from a variety of different sources to bring in and try to help officials determine how likely outbreaks are to become pandemics, among other issues. But we have a real problem in terms of basic data from countries, perhaps like China, when it comes to the origin in Wuhan. And there's a real lack of confidence over the origins of some of these. And I'm not optimistic that that will necessarily improve in certain countries of the world that we have concerns about disease origins. How much hope should we put into this new forecasting center? And do you see that as at least the seed of something that will breed something very positive to address those issues that you yourself brought up in the article?
Well, I hope so. It's clearly an important step and an important concept, and one that we've fought for quite a while. But I do think in terms of emerging infectious diseases, the fact is that the vast majority of the pathogens that we've contended with in the last 20 years, or actually 40 years, if you go back to the beginning of HIV, have been spillovers. There's not been a question about intentional release of these pathogens, except amongst conspiracy theorists, perhaps. So I think the most valuable place to start is really looking at the concept of spillover from animals to humans, or perhaps we need to be thinking about it from plant to plant, as you mentioned earlier with the climate change conversation. And there is so much open space there in terms of the surveillance for the biome of pathogens that exist in the most likely animal species, bats, rodents. You know, we have to start with the most probable scenarios. I think we've now learned perhaps finally that coronaviruses might be a place where we should spend a bit more time and energy understanding in their natural habitat and their evolution and adaptation. So I think just looking only at natural emergence, there's a huge amount of predictive science that could be brought to bear, but it does require an investment. And again, most of the places where we would most want to have that investment pay off are places where we might have the least ability to engage or the least sophistication to partner and create the kinds of environments where that is realistic. But it doesn't mean it can't happen. I think the second piece of this new entity at CDC is, given an outbreak, you know, then really predicting not necessarily its source, but predicting its pattern and its transmission and its impact. That's another whole area of modeling and data analytics that has been conducted with some success by various academic centers around the world, especially in the US, but it's still pretty primitive. And as we can tell, a lot of dogma feeds into those early analytic models. And then we end up in the situation at the other end of the funnel where the predictions really didn't hold up at all. And so we have a confused public and a further erosion of trust. So I do think that the more we can build the science around prediction, and hopefully if we're fortunate and end up getting ARPA-H or some of the other countermeasure investments appropriated, we'll also have much better countermeasures available to combat them if and when they do move. So we can begin thinking about preemption as opposed to mitigation. I see that as technically possible. I just don't know whether or not we can build the case, a strong enough case for the investments and the prioritization that something like that would really require, because it can't just be the US. It has to be you know, a global network.
Right. Matt, as Julie was talking through that, I had this idea pop into my head. So bear with me. Let's say after this conversation tonight, the president gives you a call and says, you know, I heard an idea that there should be a national intelligence manager or a national intelligence officer for global health issues. And congratulations, you know, you're my guy. And then this new center at CDC for forecasting and outbreak analytics comes to you and says, you know, instead of having your analysts come and give us briefings or even have you collect on issues related to what we do at CDC, here's what I'd like. I'd like for you to gather several dozen of your analysts and detail them to us, have them come on rotation to this center, because you folks at CIA have been doing analytics and some of these predictive things for decades on other issues in other domains. Can I have a bunch of your people to come live with us, work with us, do the work, come back better educated about the actual intelligence needs of public health officials, but also contribute to our analytic efforts? On the other hand, you've got a lot of work to do with those people in their normal jobs that you're overseeing now. How do you react to a request like that? And do you think that's something that the intelligence community could support public health by actually loaning personnel to help them on some of the issues that we've struggled with before?
You're getting a couple of principles that I'm gonna advocate. And I think you could go that direction. That could be a component. I mean, I'll play out your scenario. If I got a call tomorrow morning and the president said, hey, you're czar on this, what are you gonna do? There are resource constraints, but there are things we can do that don't take many resources. For example, and I'm talking about a model that I used when I was my penultimate job at the agency was mission manager for the Near East, South Asia, and Africa across two directorates that by normal inertia and dynamic didn't collaborate and exploit each other. I mean that in a positive way, as well as they could. So let me tell you one of the first things I do, and I'm not gonna hit all the right institutions, but I'll get some of them. You'll see where I'm going with this. This is not a big resource commitment. You put together some sort of an oversight group. It's got the intel community, NSA, CIA, all the other three-letter agencies. It's got CDC. It's got the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, and whatever others, you know, people such as Julie would recommend. You may have a couple of private sector experts in there, and they do a couple of things. I know we have the clearances issue, but, you know, somebody in Julie's position, she's got clearances. Get clearances where you have to. I'm not talking about, you know, 100 people. I'm talking about 20, 25. And they get together on a regular basis. They get together, I don't know, maybe one whole hour a month. And they share across the table what they're seeing, what they find concerning. They share imaginations of what could come out of the woods at us. And again, I think on the biology front, it's not just pandemics. You know, you want to read a scary piece. It's 100-something pages long. But in 2018, National Academy put together this biodefense in the age of synthetic biology. Read it, because that synthetic biology, again, is getting out to a broadened base of actors, and that's not good. But they get together once a month. Just getting together once a month, they develop some relationships and some comfort with each other. So if, in fact, a crisis blows up on them, they know exactly who to call. You already have an orientation and a comfort zone with each other. I mean, that's one of the great tragedies. You can have an organization together. You can have, you know, it may be physics and you've got all the Einsteins in the room, but the team dynamic is kind of broken. The facilitation dynamic doesn't work. So you could get the answers out of the group, but the comfort and the facilitation is there. So that's not a big resource thing. They get together. And I would also have them twice a year. Mm-hmm. go off for 2 days, and I'd have somebody come in and facilitate a crisis simulation. Be a little imaginative, bring in some folks that aren't from those two worlds to sort of make them think through what happens if, you know, what would be a leading indicator of this and that, you know, teach them some futures work. That's not right. A big resource commitment.
Can I just say one thing, because I don't want to go over my skis here, but, you know, this would not be the first time that members of the intelligence community have been embedded at CDC and have participated in these kinds of conversations and exercises. So, you know, they're not very conspicuous for obvious reasons, but on a small scale, this is something that has actually, at least during my tenure, was not abnormal. But, you know, the time was a little bit different then because we were coming out of the 911 environment. Yeah. So the stakes were higher. But I think your point is really well made, that this does not require a massive appropriation, but it does require leadership commitment and sustainability, because to dabble in it, we will never get anything accomplished. And, you know, I think it needs to be highly supported.
To your point, and I read your piece in Time, Julia, I thought it was fantastic. Bring in our partners, you know, at least intermittently, you know, at least regularly. So we're also talking to the Five Eyes folks. We're talking to, you know, the Taiwanese. We're talking to some other people on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Eric, I want to come back to you. We only have a few minutes left here. And I want you to put this into the bigger picture of the intelligence community. Even in the time before you joined it, had a reputation as being, I don't know what to call it, often cooperative, more cooperative than other committees, because so much work takes place in secret, perhaps there's less grandstanding. There was the opportunity sometimes to work across the aisle in a way that people in the room often said that they forgot what party their colleagues were in, which is a nice change from the dynamic we see in so many other ways. In recent years, that seems to be a little bit different. And I'm hoping you can shed some light on not just the issue of pandemics, although I think that's a big part of it, but when there is an issue that has an impact on everyone, does that give a leader of the intelligence community, a chairman and a ranking member, an opportunity to say, let's hit the reset button, let's refresh, and let's get the intelligence community fully back on that level?
Well, I miss those days. The old saying when I joined the committee was that when you walk into the SCIF, there's a door about this wide, two doors that wide that you go into. They're heavy doors, and it's heavy material that you're about you know, to digest. And they say that you check two things at the door: your phones, your electronic devices, and your politics. And if you were to look at a transcript over the past 30 years on the committee, and you were to just redact the names of the members, you would have no idea who was a Republican or who was a Democrat. So you're absolutely right, David. In that room, because there's no cameras, because there are no notes, you can't take your notes out of the room, because you don't have your personal office staff there with you, you're really just acting in the best interest of your constituents, the Constitution, and your conscience. And, you know, you really see people's real personality and their real principles come out. Now, of course, the 2016 election changed all of that. The good news is this most recent Intelligence Authorization Act was passed unanimously out of the committee. And that was because Chairman Schiff really wanted to get us back to that regular order, so to speak, as we called it, and to credit the Republicans where they could have waged battles, they chose not to, and we found consensus. Some things were left on the cutting room floor that we would prefer to have put into this bill, but we thought that it was more important to show ourselves, our colleagues in the country, that we were trying to get back to that comity. The Intelligence Committee also travels a lot because of, you know, our partnerships across the world. And in that travel, you forge relationships with your Republican colleagues, and the Republican and Democratic staffers forge relationships. Secretary Pompeo and I spent Easter Sunday 2015 together in Baghdad. And that, you know, would not happen today, right? Just because of the nature of things. And so I do hope that we get back to that type of collaborating, because what's at stake is not partisan at all. What's at stake is the national security of the country, and hoping that you're putting that first before everything else.
Yep. Julie, let me direct a quick question to you from Larry Pfeiffer. He notes that we've had this entire conversation and we have not yet mentioned the Department of Defense's National Center for Medical Intelligence. DOD is a big gorilla in the executive branch in so many ways anyway, and is leaned on in crises. Instead of having a new institution developed or worry about new centers within the CDC, should that National Center for Medical Intelligence, in a sense, become more linked to some of the public health issues and become a larger entity as a support element there?
You know, I co-chair the CSIS Commission on Global Health Security, and we are just in the process of rounding out the findings from a special working group on the role of the Department of Defense in biosecurity. And it's just been a fascinating exploration of the broader set of capabilities, requirements. It's not lost on anyone that in the middle of a crisis, we call upon the DOD to do things that probably aren't part of their concept of operations under normal circumstances. And it's a very clunky process to even get the authorizations and so forth to allow that to occur. So I think we need to really have a broad view of how can we really optimize the value of the DOD assets in biosecurity, but also what's the limit of what's appropriate for our military, and then how do we augment that or partner with it in the civilian space. We'll have to come back to you because I feel like I now need a diagram of all of these special entities within the 17 intelligence community members that are focused on these issues. I thought I understood it, but I'm obviously out of date. So I'll have to learn a little bit more before I can fully answer your question.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Look, I want all of you to do me a favor right now. We know you subscribe to the Lawfare podcast, and if you don't, you can correct that immediately. But you also should be subscribing to our other podcasts. There's the Rational Security podcast, which drops every Wednesday, and the Chatter podcast, which drops every Thursday. Please go subscribe to those as well. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha Howell. We thank the Hayden Center and the Biodefense Program at George Mason University's Schar School for help with the audio. Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.